So welcome, everyone. My name is Michelle Bix, and I'm with Canada Without Poverty.
And my name is Teresa Iyer, and I'm with Citizens for Public Justice.
And together, we are the Dignity for All campaign, our two organizations. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon in the third of Dignity for All Poverty Policy Series webinars. We have had the pleasure of being joined by some really excellent guests. If you haven't had an opportunity, if you're listening to the recording, please go and check out our other sessions on childcare, as well as our session on pharmacare. But I'm very excited to say that in this one, we'll be chatting with Catherine Scott from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives about income support, and in particular, what kind of policies exist, what we've asked for, and what we're going to be pushing for in the future, knowing that this is a year where policy is going to be talked about a whole lot coming up to the federal election. Thank you, Catherine, so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, before we all get started, many of you, I'm sure, are quite familiar with Catherine and her fantastic work, but those who aren't, I'll give a sense of her background. So Catherine is a senior researcher with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and she serves as the director for its gender equality and public policy work. She has worked in the community sector as a researcher, a writer, and an advocate over the past 20 years, writing on a range of issues from social policy to inequality to funding for nonprofits. She is passionate about research that speaks to the aspirations of communities and supports collective action for change. She has also served as Vice President of Research at the Canadian Council on Social Development for several years, and in recent years has produced research, and analysis for organizations such as Prosper Canada, Volunteer Canada, Capacity Canada, Pathways to Education Canada, and the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. And of course, Catherine lives here in Ottawa with her family, and she holds a degree in political science from Queen's University and York University. So thank you so much, Catherine, for joining us. For those of you who are just joining us as well, I'll make a note that in terms of the format of this session, we'll give Catherine a second to go through a presentation for us that she has prepared for about 15 minutes. If at any point in time you have questions, you'll see on the left-hand screen there's a box called Q&A. Please feel free to type in those questions, and at the end of the session, we'll have an opportunity to have a quick discussion and pull some pieces from there that our excellent experts hopefully can help us work through. So with all of that being said, Catherine, please take it away.
Thanks a lot, Michelle. That was a kind introduction, and I know actually, I'm thinking now that many organizations, all those Prosper Canada, Volunteer Canada, seem to have a ring to it. But anyway, I'm very pleased to be here today and doing this presentation for the folks connected to the Dignity for All campaign. It's been tremendously important work over many years, bringing the anti-poverty advocates together, focusing on certainly the compelling reasons that we do this work, but also pointing to solutions. And this, as you said, this is a key year. We're in the elections around the corner. And it's a good time to step back and take stock and to ask some important questions as we go forward. So, Michelle, why don't you flip to the first slide, and I will get going. And I am looking very much forward to your questions and happy to follow up afterwards, share my slides and all of that, or to discuss areas. This is a short presentation, so there's obviously lots that we could be talking about by way of income security policy. I'm going to focus on three things, but again, there's lots of time for conversation after the seminar. So, as I said, it's the federal election coming up, and really it's an important time for us to be looking at what our most pressing challenges are today, what the current state of our debate is right now on these policy options, and where do the opportunities, and really importantly, where the opportunities lie for progress. I think we all probably have a good sense by now that this election is shaping up to be pretty contentious. It's going to be, I would say, fairly hard to be able to cut through competing narratives on any number of different issues. On the key issue of the economy, for instance, the aggregate data look quite strong. Employment is up, average wages are finally rising after many, many years, and economic growth is positive. Yet we know that many individuals and families still struggle. In a recent CBC poll that many of you may have seen, fully one-third of respondents said that their number one issue was cost of living. High cost of essential goods like housing, like food, energy, childcare, it's weighing on everyone and most especially on marginalized groups. But the truth is that not everyone or every region or every sector is benefiting equally from our current prosperity. There are profound disparities that undermine health and thwart opportunity. By way of example, yesterday, the CCPA in collaboration with the AFN released a report that found that nearly half of Indigenous children lived in poverty in Canada in 2015, just the same as they did a decade ago. No change there. Indeed, that rate is 2.5 times the national rate. So as a clear graphic example of the disparities that exist in Canada. So, you know, from my perspective, certainly, it's an essential that these issues be front and center during the election. We need to build on current progress, such as investment in the Canada Child Benefit, to develop a strong public infrastructure of essential services and income supports that ensures that no one's left behind. Now, for me, the idea of public infrastructure is really important. Much of the popular debate, I would argue, right now is being taken up with the promises to tackle affordability by cutting taxes or offering rebates. Like Doug Ford does, government in Ontario, most recent example of the child care rebate, or putting forward incentives for families to save for education, a new home, their health care. What proponents of these sorts of ideas aren't telling you is that these moves are just another side of privatization where individuals and families are left to cope on their own with illness, job loss, or caring responsibilities, and that the tax cuts that they are advocating for will ensure that future governments aren't in a position to take positive action to tackle Canada's challenges, things like our unacceptable level of poverty, wide level of income inequality, and of course, climate action, which is critical. My view is that in the end, that policy making and budgets are about choices and values. And we have choices, and the choices that we make today will determine the long-term sustainability of our society and our economy for generations to come. The Dignity Plan back in 2015 that was released certainly made it clear that better choices are available. A more effective poverty reduction plan than the one proposed by the current government, the Liberal government in Ottawa here, requires more ambitious targets and timelines and a greater level of investment in programs such as universal childcare, national pharmacare, and training and education. So my task, as I said off the top, is to look at some proposals for income security programs. As I noted, the Liberals have taken action on several fronts, but clearly additional investment is needed. So I'm going to look at three areas, drawing on information that we've collected here at the CCPA for the alternative federal budget. This is a annual project that brings together over 100 groups to develop and debate progressive policy proposals. So I'll have a quick overview of three policy areas and then we'll open it up for questions. Michelle, why don't you flip to the first, here we go. There, okay. So first up, poverty reduction in the provinces and the territories. Many of you will know, certainly, that provincial social assistance is a shadow of what it was, certainly back in the early 1990s. The purchasing power of welfare benefits has plummeted, and new rules have made assistance much, much harder to get. The good news is that many provinces and territories have or some form of a poverty reduction plan. The bad news is that some plans have expired and have yet to be renewed. In 2015, the Dignity Plan called on the federal government to enhance funding to the provinces and territories via the Canada Social Transfer to help support these poverty reduction efforts and to tie those investments to targets, timelines, and measurements to improve accountability. It also called on the government to reinstate minimum national standards for provincial income assistance through conditions and with specific consideration to key groups such as persons with disabilities. The Liberal government, the federal Liberal government, has largely adopted the measures, however, set in place by the former Conservative government, particularly with respect to the CST, that's the Canada Social Transfer, the result of which is that federal transfers have been declining as a share of GDP over many years and that will continue to decline going into the future. So that means that the provinces will continue to struggle to finance effective poverty reduction, certainly in the face of rising health care costs. In the alternative federal budget, we've actually proposed a new federal transfer payment to the provinces and territories to help them achieve their poverty reduction targets in the sum of roughly $4 billion per year. This would be money on top of the current CST. The intent then would to make sure that this new transfer, that these funds would be used by provinces and territories to substantially increase social assistance benefits and to expand eligibility. Next slide, moving forward. There we go. EI, or employment insurance, also is another vital part of Canada's social safety net, but successive governments have made the program less equitable and much harder to access. Social insurance programs should dampen the effects of labor market inequality, but our EI system actually amplifies them. So again, looking at what over the past 4 years, what's been achieved, the Liberal government rolled back several Harper-era reforms, including the definition of suitable work. They reduced the wait time for benefits, and they've introduced more flexible parental leave options. And actually a new federal parental sharing benefit, They've also increased funding for employment and training programs managed by provinces, territories, and Aboriginal organizations. And in budget 2019, there's a new Canada training benefit, teeny tiny benefit, in the last budget. These changes, of course, are welcome, but effectively, there's been no substantive fundamental reform of the system in over 20 years, and certainly not no reforms that would update the system for today's labor market or address issues of access and systemic bias. The government's also undercut the ability of the program to respond to pressing needs by reducing premiums. And so effectively, the cuts to premiums will mean that revenues for the EI fund are reduced actually in the order of $3.6 billion per year over the next 7 years. So we're, again, digging a large revenue hole here. So certainly at CCPA and others believe immediate action is needed, as we've recommended also in the Dignity Plan in 2015. We need to absolutely expand access to the program and to enhance the support that's offered to the unemployed, new parents, caregivers, and workers who are coping with illness. So this would require, and you'll see on the slide here, some of the policy proposals we put forward, instituting a new uniform entry requirement for regular and special benefits. The recommendation here is roughly 360 hours to qualify for regular benefits and 300 hours for special benefits. We're looking at lowering thresholds for accessing benefits of maximum duration, and looking at higher income replacement rates. Canada actually has quite low rate at 55% of your earnings. Many other countries have much higher levels of income replacement. We know, for instance, that racialized and Indigenous workers, workers with disabilities, and female workers are all disproportionately represented in low-wage precarious work. We think EI should help level the playing field for these workers. And one way to do that would be to set a minimum floor for EI benefits. So while the EI program currently has a low-income supplement for families with kids, the AFB proposed a low-income supplement for those without children, effectively a floor of at least $300 per week. And this would be a meaningful step toward reducing inequality for low-income workers in this program. The next slide. I'm sorry, I know I'm zooming through this. I'm trying to leave quite time for questions in the end. There we go. So lastly, turning to seniors' benefits. Again, this we were looking at what we asked for back in the Dignity Plan and what the government, current federal government, delivered and what we're looking for moving forward. we know that the Canada Pension Plan and Old Age Security are cost-effective and sustainable programs, but they're currently falling short of their goals. After a steady decline in the rate of poverty among seniors over many decades, we're now seeing an increase and have done for the last decade or so. According to the census, there were over 400,000 seniors living in poverty measured by Canada's new official poverty line, the market basket measure. And the future looks troubling as fewer and fewer workers belong to workplace pension plans and private savings are at all-time low. So the Liberal government, as you see here on this slide, introduced several positive reforms in 2016, notably increasing the GIS top-up, that's the guaranteed income supplement that goes to low-income seniors, and certainly for the most vulnerable, including many, many women living alone. They also eliminated the planned increase on the age of retirement. That was one of the sort of most prominent Harper-era reforms that were brought in or was proposed to have been brought in back in 2016. And they've launched several initiatives to try to improve take-up of benefits. And this last budget actually took action to improve the earnings exemption for in terms of the GIS, the amount of money that you would retain from employment earnings before phasing out your GIS benefits. Moving forward, we would like to see certainly a greater attention paid to low-income seniors. We think that given the whole area of earnings exemptions, and in particular exemption for, the screen's just gone blank, sorry, particularly the exemption of CCP benefits is a critical issue for eligibility to the GIS. We would certainly, we propose to expand the income exemption for determining eligibility to by exempting the first $1,500 of CCP benefits. And we believe as well, in terms of the CCP itself, that we would increase the planned, the replacement rate from the planned 33% to 50% of earnings over time, believing that putting CCP on a much stronger footing and increasing the benefits that seniors will receive in retirement. The CCP disability program also demands attention. The AFB proposes to increase monthly benefit rate, to expand the definition of disability, and to loosen eligibility requirements to ensure that more people with disabilities actually qualify for the benefit. The requirements right now are quite stringent, and many people are unable to access these benefits. Another significant step would be to take the current federal disability tax credit, which is non-refundable, and to make this a refundable credit so that, like the GST credit, it would go to all people who need assistance, regardless, even those whose incomes are so low they don't pay income tax. So these are some of the sort of proposals that the AFB, the Alternative Federal Budget Community, has developed over the last number of years. Certainly they resonate with many proposed in the Dignity Plan back in 2015. Many other areas of income support that we've touched, but I'm happy to take questions about these proposals or your other thoughts about how this election is shaping up and how we can make an effective push to make sure that poverty is a key issue going forward.
Thank you so much, Catherine. If any of you have questions, feel free to write them in into the Q&A section of the webinar, just on the left of your screen. I'll start with one. Catherine, you touched a little bit on the programs themselves. I'm wondering, what powers does the federal government have in these programs, and how can they be used to close gaps in provincial or territorial programs as well?
Well, I mean, the first area was the Canada Social Transfer. Certainly the federal government has jurisdiction in certain selected areas like employment insurance and the like. It has obviously control over the federal tax system. It also has an enormous amount of control and ability to make, through the transfer system to provinces and territories, to help shape provincial policies and programs. And it certainly used to be back in the day, when the Canada Assistance Plan was in place, the federal government would transfer money to the provinces and territories subject to a number of conditions. They, in fact, still do that under the Canada Health Act, There are at least four or five requirements for receipt of money. But these, the conditions on the social side were abandoned in the mid-1990s when the federal government massively cut back transfers. So this has been a long-term irritant. Money is transferred to the provinces, yet there's no guarantee that the provinces in turn will direct those monies to important critical areas. Childcare is a current example. And what type of reforms are being brought in by the provinces and territories? It's wholly within the province or the federal government's remit to attach conditions to and principles to the transfer of monies to the provinces. They've just chosen not to do so in recent years. That's been a big point, and certainly that's certainly a fight worth fighting to make these changes possible.
Catherine, I might jump in actually with one question for you that occurred to me. Often I find when I'm chatting with people about different income support programs, I often get the question to reflect a little bit on eligibility processes and the ways that they can stigmatize and discriminate against people living in poverty. Sometimes the barriers that people face in being able to access programs. I'm thinking most notably, and of course, in light with the report that was just released about poverty among First Nations children, and the study not so long ago that points to another program, the Canada Child Benefit, not adequately reaching First Nations children. And I wonder if you have any kind of reflections on that point about eligibility for programs, about being able to meet the criteria that government set. If in all of your work on income support, this is a theme that you've seen come up.
Well, it's a huge theme. Certainly, we set up these programs and, we can talk about this for a long time. Typically Canada sort of fits into the mold. It's been the programs it's introduced to support low-income people have historically been very minimal and narrowly targeted. And so Canada is under, and social assistance is a great example. They have built up a large bureaucracy to ensure that the undeserving poor are filtered out in some fashion with myriads of rules around, any number of things. Certainly this is true for people with disabilities that face competing and conflicting rules and eligibility requirements. And so the drive for a simpler, a more efficient, more humane and rights-based system is a really is very important and powerful. So that's proceeding in some fashion. At the same time, and we see some of this, you see some of this happening. So as Canada or the federal government's move to use the tax system, for instance, to deliver income security so that, eligibility is just determined at tax time when you file your return and whether you meet a certain set of requirements on income and then you're eligible for the benefit, like the GST credit, for instance. And so I think people feel that is not as intrusive. So I think there's a real issue here. And it's just the tension in the system, right? The more complex and highly targeted is, the more challenging it becomes. So the question you raise around kids living on reserve and the children that are missing is then, so if you turn to using the tax system or a vehicle like that to deliver income programs, and people aren't actually filing income tax returns, it leaves you wide open to all sorts of people who actually will not receive the benefit to which they're entitled. And so it's a really big issue. That's true for seniors. And so that's why you see some governments taking actions to proactively enroll people in programs so that it's not contingent upon people filing tax returns and the like, to go out and seek out people. And that's critically important to do in remote rural communities on reserve, where, and certainly I think with the move to greater levels of self-government, hopefully some of these problems around finding the people, making sure that the people who are eligible for the support get the support, hopefully that'll improve going forward.
So speaking of taxes,
What is something you would say to folks who respond that Canada doesn't have the money to cover changes like the ones that you suggested?
Well, you know, that's the big question, right? Canada actually, by international standards, is actually a very modest spender when it comes to income security programs. In fact, there are other countries that commit much larger portions of their budget to supporting the income security programs. You know, we've had 20 years of successive tax cuts, certainly on the corporate side, but also on the personal side, which has really reduced quite significantly revenues going to the federal government or going actually to provinces and territories as well. And so this becomes a question of sort of a chicken and egg question. Like, you know, the question then becomes, are these programs important? Canada is a very wealthy country and can certainly afford this. Do we choose to put a priority on poverty reduction? How are we going to equitably generate the revenues to support people in the community? That, for me, is the question. Because as a proportion, you know, even under the Liberal government, and they've made significant investments in certain areas like Canada Child Benefit, keep changing the name of that program, in the face of that, we're still comparatively spending as a proportion of GDP, comparatively one of the lowest points in our history post-Second World War. So people say, oh, how can we afford it? We can more than afford it if we choose to afford it. And we have other countries who do very well economically. It's not zero sum, and also provide a much more generous welfare state.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Catherine. I see that there's a couple of questions that have come in from participants, but knowing that we don't have tons more time, what I'm going to do is maybe I'll ask them all together and I'll get you to kind of reflect on all three of them. So Alex has asked about some of the biggest myths or preconceived notions about social assistance and income support, in your opinion. We also have a question from Nairn about the intersection between a whole bunch of different issues with income support. So the ways that income support can intersect with the fight for quality childcare, and especially when there is an underlying assumption that there are quality jobs available for people who can't access childcare. So a question about, I think, the intersection between childcare and income support and jobs. And then last but not least, there is a question about minimum wage and what that means for income support and how when one is working a minimum wage job, how this can come in mind and how that works, of course, with gaps in employment that doesn't, for example, guarantee benefits or insurance. So those are some big questions for you, but if you want to take a stab maybe in a minute or two, to some of the themes that have come up there.
Well, on the minimum wage question, just quickly off the top, I think the move at the provincial level over the past few years, I know it's sort of slowed up now with this new round of provincial premiers, but to raise the minimum wage, certainly up to $15 an hour, that was true in some provinces. The living wage campaign in many provinces has been really important. And, you know, it's interesting in the data to see that actually is having a huge impact, certainly in raising up the level wage, the earnings of low-income families, certainly provides the floor. And to that extent, you know, when we look at income security programs, we have to critically look at the labor market and what the wages are on offer. So the push for higher minimum wage has been really important as it basically pushes up the floor and it provides more security for people who are in those jobs or working multiple jobs. I think the push, again, is to provide additional supports like childcare, available drug costs and the like, hopefully our national pharmacare, to support low-wage workers who still at $15 an hour, that given the cost in Canada, you know, it will remain a very challenging task to make ends meet. So again, the push then becomes on what are the other supports available to low-wage workers that would assist in creating an equitable, healthy lives for everyone. To that extent, I think childcare remains a critical anti-poverty program. I know it's childcare, we can talk about it differently and broadly as important early child development initiative as well as facilitating women's labor market employment, but it is a critical anti-poverty program. And in fact, you know, Canada remains quite much a laggard. Our child care system is just woefully inadequate to what it needs to be to sustain and support and children and their families in a way that's necessary as they to develop and help and to their most full potential. I know Morna probably spoke at length about that in the new proposals for the child care program. Hopefully that'll be debated in the upcoming election. And the last question which one was, Michelle? It was on the administration? No, the very first one.
That was the note on myths and preconceived
notions. Myths. Well, you know, on social assistance, there are so many myths that, what are the myths? The fundamental myth that somehow social assistance is basically only available to the undeserving poor who don't work or who choose not to work, are lazy, all of these really damaging, pernicious myths about what it is to be in low income and the precarity of one's life. I think social assistance reinforces many of those myths, the system that's currently set up, when it should be designed to create a platform where people find security who, through no fault of their own, coping with chronic illness or challenges, loss of a spouse, difficulties, have the support they need to live healthy, happy lives. So I think, you know, that myth of the undeserving poor stays with us and is so damaging.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine. That was an incredibly well done and succinct presentation. And thank you so much for answering those questions so thoughtfully. It's a lot, I think, for a lot of folks to think about. I want to just kind of wrap us up and thank so much those who have joined us and those who are listening now for tuning in again. I'm happy to say that this is number 3 in our 6-part poverty policy series. And we have another one coming at you next week, which is July 17th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And next week we will be talking about jobs and employment and what policy changes need to be made to address the gaps in jobs and employment for folks living in poverty. So we hope that you will join us. And thank you so very much again, Catherine, for spending this time with us and for your very thoughtful and excellent insight into the issue. So thanks very much.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care, everyone.